Welcome to the Dahlgren Centennial Celebration, a century of innovation. We hope that this and our many other products, events, and offerings will showcase what Dahlgren has accomplished during its last 100 years. Throughout our history, we've interviewed some of the most prominent minds, leaders, and innovators that have been here, and we're opening up the vault to share them with you this year. Today, we're honored to listen to the stories of both Barry Dillon and Joe Francis. Their podcast will cover the early history of Theater Warfare Systems, which was known as T Department in the early 2000s. Theater Warfare Systems particularly focuses on interoperability, missile defense, and precision strike.
This is Jamie Rife, and I'm at Theater Warfare Systems, and I'm interviewing Barry Dillon and Joe Francis. And we're going to talk about the history of Theater Warfare Systems, as well as management and current challenges from the 1980s to 1990s. First question, gentlemen, is could both of you just briefly give me your background, career, and how you both came to Dahlgren?
Joe Francis, I came to Dahlgren in June 1964 as a physicist working in the HERO division at the time in the research branch. In about a year, they sent me back to graduate school to become an electrical engineer with a master's degree. Returned to Dahlgren with a commitment to work at least 10 years. I've been at Dahlgren ever since in various departments, from the old engineering department, then into the F department. I've been in G department. I've been in K department. I've been in most departments except N. In fact, I was in the N but once upon a time, but not in the Aegis part back in the old days under Paul Wessel. I've been in most of the departments at Dahlgren.
Hey, how about you, Barry?
Most of my career, all but 3 years, that I've just been in the Naval Aviation community, and started working in science and technology for ASW and did that for about 7 years. Then moved into infrared sensors on joint programs. Then moved into the F-14 and became the deputy program manager for the F-14, and then was picked up director of surveillance and avionics for all of naval aviation. Moved from that into the director of the unmanned aerial vehicle joint project office and deputy PEO for cruise missiles and UAVs. Did that for about 8 or 9 years. Went down to Panama City for 3 years. Was a department head down there in the research, incorporated special ops and amphibious warfare domains into that. And then I've been here since March of 2000.
What can you tell me about the history of T Department? From what did it derive, what was its origins, and what was its original mission, and how's that evolved, and what does it do today?
I don't know the exact date, but we used to have an A Department for warfare analysis created, out of some key warfare analysis talent that was at the GS-15 level on staff, plus some other branches that were in various divisions at the time. Anyway, A Department was created under Chris Calvertinus. And that ran for 2 or 3 years and included modeling work like Mars. And then Tom Pendergraph, who was head of F Department at the time, I think was probably the first to realize that the nature of our work in the future was going to be at a higher level in developing individual systems. So he realized that we were going to be developing warfare level systems and that we needed to create a department that would focus on that. So I believe he was the principal instigator for creating what we now call T Department. As distinct from the old T Department a long time ago, which was TEP, this T Department is very much theater, warfare level system engineering kind of work and things that go with that. So I was in A Department at the time as the deputy department head under Chris Calvertinus, and A Department was decided should be merged with F Department. Primarily, those two departments would then make up T Department, and that was approved by the board, under Pendergraph's leadership, and we brought together a whole bunch of GS-15s out of both of these departments, so reallocated the various jobs, created new divisions, and one innovative thing that we did was to match leading senior program manager positions to sort of area program managers to individual divisions and the division heads. So we had partnerships between lead program managers on department staff, of which I was one of the original ones, actually I'm the only remaining one, and the individual division. So there was one for anti-air warfare, matched with the anti-air warfare, or the maritime defense division as we called it at the time, and there was one for, warfare systems engineering kind of stuff, which had a slightly different name at the time under Dick Whalen, and Land Attack, which I was leading at the time and still am trying to. So, we had this match of lead program managers and division head with responsibilities to support each other. The program managers were responsible to help the division. The division was responsible to help the program managers. It was a true partnership sort of arrangement. It was even written into our annual goals and objectives. But with the transitioning nature of programs and pieces of programs, and all this has now changed. So all of the programmatic work I think we have now is under the individual division heads, with the exception of what I represent here, staff. Now, the date for that, I can't remember exactly. I think it was about early 98 or late 97, formed T department. But I can remember being in A department about 8 months or so before we began transitioning. Then we sort of converged A department into a division, into a division of the new T as part of that merging process before the, you know, before the transition was completed.
What are some of the major technical developments?
Let me explain maybe where we are, mm-hmm. the evolution over the 6 or 7 years. When I got here in 2000, things like interoperability and battle groups and battle forces were just starting to become understood and known. And things like the missile defense activities that we're reading about in the Washington Post, mm-hmm. in order to defend this country, as well as to apply them to the Navy and sea-based components, we're still in early phase of development. One of the things we've tried to do in this department is to take the 5 divisions and really focus them on the initiatives and the efforts of the theater workers. So our total mission is to be the United States Navy lead in addressing what the requirements, needs, and what needs to be developed, and the systems engineering associated with that to satisfy theater systems of operation. Today, that is the foresight of the people to generate this department, I think, are very, very essential. We no longer concentrate or just concentrate on making a product. It's not even adequate or sufficient to make a ship totally interoperable amongst itself. It is essential that these ships be interoperable in a battle group configuration. It is essential that they go to a large area of operation like a theater of operation, and they be able to work in a joint manner with coalition forces, and that they achieve all the dynamics, all the flexibility, all the interoperability that can be taken from that level of operation. It's required us to understand strategic systems and to overlay those and to be able to provide and sift, if you will, the information and get it to the tactical users. It's required us to think net-centric, and it's required us to think interoperability at very high levels, more than interfaces, the real engineering of interoperability. So in this department, our mission is to go about and to lead a team of people, recognizing that maybe all the expertise isn't found in this department, but a lot of the expertise is found throughout the Dolphin Division, and to work programs not only vertically, but to work programs more horizontally across all the assets of Dolphin in order to satisfy and to meet these needs and to be able to deal with these issues and problems. So we take that very seriously in our goals and what we have laid out. So we have 4 strategic goals that we've had in place here for the last 3 years. In my opinion, we've made steady and continued progress on, and I think they've paid off in the recent. One is interoperability, particularly at the battle group and at the coalition levels in the joint war. Another is missile defense, both self-defense of our ships, which our product lines are improving significantly compared to earlier years. Part of that's just the progression of development, but I think our ability to address and to design those and to bring them out has improved, as well as to be able to provide a sea-based element of missile defense. The other is precision strike or land attack, which Joe has had a principal involvement in, and we feel that being able to put the right weapons in the right place precisely, minimizing collateral damage, and to be able to do that for a wide array of sensors and the hooking up of a wide array of sensors as well as weapons is very important. So we've been working strongly to understand how to do the mission planning and the fire control, and to be able to do those in a theater warfare type basis. Our ships now can fire weapons that go anywhere from 0 to in excess of 1,200 nautical miles and everything in between. How do you come up with a fire control to be able to manage all of that? And then developing these theater warfare systems engineer requires us to be able to use the assets about Dahlgren and to bring about change and that. So we've had those strategic focuses, and as a result of that, there's been a lot of spinoff. Today, this department is out of people. It is not out of money. Too few people to do all the jobs that we've got, which is a good thing because it's got other problems, but it's not the usual problems of not having sufficient support or not having sufficient dollars. So we're finding that we feel that we're very relevant to the needs of the Navy, very relevant to today's time, because we work horizontally, we have a lot of flexibility in what we're doing, and we feel like we're at the cutting edge of the key program. People that set up this department, I think, had good vision. Hindsight, they had very good vision.
And the way we structured and kind of melded that, I think we've been able to get into the really the most prominent and the most important working areas of our Navy, and to be able to support them and they have the technical need to be able to offer some value.
What are some of the product lines that's in the fleet and elsewhere?
A lot of people don't realize we do an awful lot of work on GPS in terms of the satellites, and we do that for the nation, not just our Navy, but its accuracy and its ability to remain accurate, certainly from the satellite orbits, is something we have physicists and mathematicians that do that. And they work for all the key agencies of the Department of Defense as well as the nation. We have a great and strong interface with NEMA in terms of precision location and digital maps. We are leading certainly Dahlgren and leading even NAVSEA with options for sea-based missile defense. We're very active with Patriot. We're very active in the ground missile defense, those type of activities. So we do both the sensors as well as the signal processing to be able to make the detection, as well as the BMC-4I, or the Battle Management Communications Command and Control, to be able to detect, engage, and target, and then if necessary, hit and kill. And to be able to engage that on a global basis, we might make detections somewhere across the Pacific or the Atlantic Ocean. We need to cue the people here in CONUS of that happening, even if we're able to take it out in proximity. So that's one product area. To be able to provide DC cooperative engagement systems, to be able to provide, we do all the development of combat systems for non-Aegis, so we're very much into the combat system development, putting those in and improving them, and take that very serious. We have a very serious effort in looking at battle groups and the engineering associated and the trades that need to be made to ensure those are up and operating in limited time and limited dollars. And we look at that on a battle group by battle group basis and make engineering decisions on what's to be done and how to do it on a battle group by battle group. That's only taken place here in the last couple of years. But it's a big focus, a different focus than what was done before, where you might look at a ship by ship basis. We're looking at it across the board on a battle group by battle group and interfacing with a lot of senior people in NAVSEA to pull that off. We do a lot of work in interoperability. We have the distributed engineering plant, which actually has 14 different sites from around the country, to include Air Force, Army, and a couple sites that are being stood up overseas. Actually take existing actual hardware and play it simultaneously, just prescribed scenarios, and be able to deduce from that what a battle group's capabilities and limitations are going to be in a full interoperability engagement. We then go out and actually engage the fleet before they go on their deployments, and based on that, and goes all the way from the senior chiefs to the senior commanding officer, then those are actually going to their CONOPs, and they use that information then against the threat. They know what their capabilities are, and they know what their limitations, and they evolve and develop their CONOPs. Mm-hmm. We do that for every battle group that gets deployed in the United States Navy. We also do a lot of work on new concepts of net-centric, new ways of coupling and correlating, and new ways of spreading information around, commonly referred to as TCN and CEC. New ways of ensuring that we have all the advantages of early detection, situation awareness, cueing, targeting, so that we can make the proper decisions and do those as quick as necessary, but certainly in advance of any emerging threat. We have probably the strongest group of technical people able to produce sensors anywhere in the Navy. We have people that understand the technology of certainly the spy radar, they understand the future development of radars and where that's going with multi-phase digital techniques. Understand the signal processing, understand the clutter environment, and we've made tremendous improvements and strides and capability by adjusting those and being able to protect those. We now have radars that can do simultaneous detection of multiple targets in all sorts of different areas, be able to provide extensive ranges and extensive detections, which gives them a lot of flexibility. We also do that for electro-optic, laser systems, and a whole host of things. And another product line we do is we do all the assessments, all the analysis, and we even do kind of thought pieces, if you will, for senior levels of OSD, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as well as CNO and other places of the Navy, on what are some options and what are some analyses. For example, the DD-21, the basis for the DD-21 was due to a cost and effectiveness analysis that work was performed here. The trade-offs for the literal combatant system are analysis that's actually being done here. We're starting to do anti-submarine warfare studies for OSD, anticipating that being a new threat area as we operate more and more in the theater of operation. So all of this, our job, Joe's and mine and the other people here, to look at all of that and figure out where the next heading and the next direction of the theater of operation is. By the way, we also work strongly with the Air Force and very strongly with the Army in looking at all these, because they're an integral part of that operating community.
So essentially the mission is to predict the future.
We try to predict it. We try to give options for the future as we look ahead. And another way I would describe it in the simple terms is we try to make sure that there's a system engineering or a system construct. All of that fits in and that it makes sense. There's kind of an architecture that if you come and you're able to do that, there's a place where it fits better. There's an interface which needs to be accommodated, that it has a home, and that it contributes at those theater of operation levels, not just at a lower tactical level, and that it can be properly interfaced and integrated. And, you know, if you look back a couple of years, people kind of thought about that. If you look at things now, people mandate to understand the systems and can articulate and put it in that perspective.
Does T Department initiate any of its own research, or do you only respond to requests from the fleet or from the Air Force or from other services?
People like Joe, people like Roger Horman and Dr. Evans, a lot of people initiate not only new concepts, new ideas, but those two guys that I just mentioned, for example, actually developed advanced technology concept of ACTVs, which is a way of getting OSD dollars. We initiated a lot of work in the S&T community with respect to LNR and DARPA and have several programs in there, as well as we work with other organizations to generate those development programs. So we do a substantial amount of early development as well as system engineering and development to get things fielded and implemented.
Joe probably, he's been around a lot longer, probably know more about how this fits into the grander scheme of Dahlgren's history, and that one of the fundamental struggles that has gone on here since Dahlgren was founded in 1918 is a struggle between the fundamental research end in which the scientists generate what's being developed and the direction of the research takes, and then the military's needs. And the early part of World War II has actually clashed spectacularly with Dr. Thompson, Dr. L.T.E. Thompson, when they brought in some old line gunnery officers to run the place, and it caused a serious rift. The irony of it is that at the end of World War II, even though these old line gun officers ran the place in 1945, the scientists were emerging as preeminent, and they were saying this a large part of the research agenda. So it's in a lot of ways it's culminating. It seems like it culminates with the T Department in that. How's the relationship with the military? Is it really close? Is there any problems?
My observation is we have very few military in the department, which I wish I could change. We're supposed to have a military deputy, and that would be very, very good, because understanding that perspective, understanding the sense of urgency, and being able to get a better feel for what the user intends to do or how what changes they might have to go through to incorporate a different product line are all very, very important. To include, you know, the elements more in the back end of the development, the training and the cycles there. But we have, I think, a phenomenal rapport with the fleet. For example, Land Fleet, which also works as a combined forces command for the Pacific Fleet as well. For example, when we do these battle groups, we are actually performing that program, and we are in compliance with the fleet instruction. They are the ones providing the guidance. They're asking for these products, and we interface directly with them on those capabilities and limitations. They drive the scenarios. They drive the composition, certainly, of the battle group. So our interface is very, very direct with the fleet and very good. I don't think they would deploy without understanding what those capabilities. They want to deploy. They feel that would be very risky and unwise to do it. New programs that are going to go into OPAVEL and very significant tests. More and more they're coming here to get the pretest and get that worked out, knowing that we can test it very, very well. We can wring it out, and then when they go and deploy and actually get on a ship and go out to sea, they can pass the test. So we have done a much, much better job of making the land-based test true to what the users need and true to the environment they ultimately put it in. My sense is some of these things, like dealing with the theater of operation, dealing with five battle groups in the same body of water, some of those are so complex that they just want an organization to look at those, understand what the limitations are, and advise them, you know, technically what's going on. They can, you know, then address them from a military or a user need. Those are the kind of things we do. We tend to send out a lot of advisories, a lot of heads up, and then we also get involved into the actual fixes. When we make changes as a result of these tests and we actually modify software and that, we engage them. They're very active participants. They're called OAGs, Operational Advisory Group. They actually chair those. So we're doing those fixes. We're making those changes on their behalf for them. And then, you know, when we get those priorities, we know what those are. Whatever the available dollars, then we do those top priorities and the others don't get done because we don't have the limited resources to do those. So we take that very seriously. That's a good working relationship. Even in the case of the analysis and those things, we work very, very closely with the folks, predominantly in those cases with the OPNAV, a lot of kind of one-on-one. So I think it's really good. It's really healthy. And we take a lot of pride in those interfaces and nurturing those and keeping them just that way.
Today, you ask four different people what the Dahlgren way is, you might get five different answers. The Dahlgren way derives from the 1920s with the arrival of Dr. L.T.E. Thompson as the first chief physicist at Dahlgren. And he was a firm believer in fundamental or pure research, in which scientists here at the facility would essentially inaugurate a project and then develop the concept and then take it out to the fleet, test it and prove it, and then bring it back and just generally follow it all the way through from concept to service. He left Dahlgren in 1940 as a result of the problems with some of the old line gunnery officers. He was having trouble getting his research implemented as well as some of his ideas. So he left and went on to greater things. He actually ended up at China Lake and became the first technical director out there. But in the 50s, after he had left, there was a lull, and the researchers and the scientists here sort of moved away from that. They started responding primarily to fleet needs and the needs of the Navy and the government rather than initiating really anything on their own. That was just a reflection of the times. Later, with Barney Smith and Jim Covard in the late 60s, early 70s, who had worked under Thompson at China Lake, they brought the Dahlgren way back to Dahlgren. Since then, it's developed on its own. So I was wondering if you had any kind of comments on what you may feel is the Dahlgren way or your perception of the Dahlgren way.
Beginning with 1964, my impression of the Dahlgren way was that it was a very much hands-on, do a competent engineering job for the Navy, and recognizing right in the beginning that our warfighters at sea are our customers. And if we get in trouble, you know, it's usually because we're trying to do the right job for the warfighters, whether or not it's perceived as the right job by everybody else. A strong commitment to doing the right thing for the Navy, I think, is part of the Dahlgren way. And a good, solid engineering approach, understanding your objectives or doing the operational analysis work up front so that you really understand what the needs are, and translating that, you know, through a competent system engineering approach into design constructs and allocations of requirements, and build all the pieces and ensure that you have the interfaces and ensure that this stuff is going to operate properly for the warfighter and be a viable warfighting asset, not just a neatsy keensy technology box. So I think Dahlgren has been appreciated by a lot of people over many years for actually delivering valuable products, or working closely with contractors who in turn will do the finishing, if you will, the product engineering and the production for valuable products. I can even tell you, I mean, even though this place, this NSWC Dahlgren, is focused and has been focused on the surface Navy, you know, the surface combatant, the gun shooters and the missile shooters, anti-submarine guys and all that. I got, two or three years ago, I got to go aboard the Teddy Roosevelt carrier, and I was surprised, you know, I looked at their big system diagram of all the systems they had, that there were four systems on that carrier that I had been responsible for at one time or another in my career here, responsible for the development of, which surprised me, because we expect all of our stuff to go to surface combatants, and yet, you know, there were four systems on a carrier that really came to Dahlgren. And I would bet that no one on that ship knew that Dahlgren, you know, was the principal technical agent for creating that stuff, because they always recognized it as Texas Instruments stuff or Raytheon stuff or Lockheed stuff, because that's the name that ends up on it. So I think in many cases we're a lot more valuable than even the warfighters realize. But I believe that our relationship with the warfighters is probably stronger than most labs because of our strong focus on delivering things to them that work, and working with them closely to make sure that the things they have get improved or fixed. And the interoperability work is extremely important for the carrier battle groups, and probably enhances our reputation with them a lot. We have historically suffered in our reputation with the fleet being less than it's deserved, because the products we work on, you know, can be 10 years or 5 years before they actually get to the fleet, so that a lot of the stuff that we create and produce gets transitioned to other key players for in-service support and stuff, and we don't get the recognition for what we do. If we were fully recognized for everything that we did good for the Navy, our stock would probably go up about 1,000%.
100%.
With respect to the Dahlgren story, there are other organizations that have a reputation for creating prototypes and have a reputation for creating technology and have a reputation for doing analysis, but also have a reputation for not being able to produce, not being able to deliver. Dahlgren has a strong reputation for delivering real capabilities that are warfighting assets. And that's because, you know, when we come in here as a GS-7 or even a GS-5, we start with that sort of focus as a Dahlgren way. Well, the other thing I would say is it's really important to balance responding to program managers in Washington to deliver, to develop those things for which awards have been created, and maybe concept work was even done by other people other than Dahlgren, to respond to those and do the engineering development, get the products out the door. It's also important to balance that with the innovative work we need to do to address the future, creation of concepts, advancing of technology, the matching of future technologies with future concepts, and helping orchestrate a large warfare system kind of view with the right kind of interfaces so that the system of the future with these new technologies is going to operate much better than today, you know, even though we make all these changes. In other words, be able to do these changes in a very carefully, technically organized way. I realize in writing your history, there have been times in our history when the researchers, if you will, the technologists have been more in charge. Other times when the engineers focused on getting the products out the door, been more in charge, and that's gone back and forth. But it's really important that we have a reasonable balance of both of those things, I think, and to do the right job for the Navy.
Seems like Dahlgren has really come of age in the last 20 years. Outside influences and challenges, how has the T Department dealt with governmental issues? I know it's, since it's a relatively new organization, that, you know, it came later after the BRACs, but some of our other interviews with a couple of the former commanding officers, they spoke of a technological and management chasm, not gap, but chasm, that formed in the last 10 years. Has T Department been affected by a preponderance of really high senior level management types and lower level engineering technical people with nothing in the middle?
Seems like the mid-30s to mid-40s, there's a gap in just about all our organizations where there was either insufficient hiring or, you know, the ability to attract really just was at an all-time low. We in this department have actually gone through the worst of the experiences already. About 2 years ago, we had a maximum number, the largest number of retirements. People that were beyond the 55, most of them 56, 57, 58, chose to retire in pretty large numbers. And we're gone through that. We're retiring almost at half the rate that we were 2 years ago. We, in my opinion, got through that. All right, I don't think we had too big of a problem doing that, but it was a struggle. It was hard. Fortunately, we've been able to get new people in. My sense is the other departments here at Dahlgren, because they're not as senior and because this really was a collection of more senior people to address kind of these more challenging things when I was first conceived, they are going to go through that. And so we're going to see Dahlgren, you know, that process where we went through, others going through it or about to go through it. But it will happen, and you're starting to see that in a couple of the other departments already, and eventually they all will. What we've done is we've hired an exceptionally large number of people. We've hired over 250 here in the last 3 years, just in this department alone. So we've gone out of our way to do that. We've only set the levels high in terms of our qualifications. We've been hiring young folks out of college as well as journeymen and been able to attract them. You know, world events help, the economy helps, but the nature of what we do, I think, has attracted a lot of people to this organization. So at the moment, we're the largest we've ever been. We've actually grown. We're very blessed to have more than enough money to certainly pay all the salaries. We have the problem of too few people to do all the jobs. That's it. Fabulous situation to be in. My hope is that world events aren't going to change that a whole lot next year, but they could. We could find things turning and changing. I think there's going to be a lot of traditional and classical programs that are going to go by the way. People are tired of nurturing programs that have been around 10 years, willing to start new and get later technology or maybe do without them. If they were good for 10 years, they may not have that validity now. So part of our job is recognizing those and providing options and decision makers. We end up with products that are useful and meaningful. So we have gone through that, and I know that gap still exists somewhat, but we're bridging that. We've been doing the good recruiting. It is going to be a problem for Dahlgren. There are going to be continued exodus here of these senior people. You just can't replace them. So we've gone on a campaign of indicating to everybody that succession planning is every individual's job. Mm-hmm. It's not somebody else's. It's not over there. It's not here. Each of us have to prepare our next in line. That's part of our job, part of our responsibilities. We've got to mentor. You have to mentor. You need to mentor. And then we're also taking great strides to ensure that our younger people are doing the right development and taking these courses. And it's harder to do than it sounds. We'll take care of themselves. People can plan their own future. takes a lot of energy to do that, but we're imposing that on them nonetheless so that they can emerge and they can fill these gaps and we can do the best job we can with the people we have.
One of the running themes throughout Dahlgren's history is one, well, it's actually two related themes, but they're intertwined. One's mathematics, other's computers. And this goes all the way back, really, to 1920 with the Norden bomb site, in which, okay, they developed bombs, but developing the bombs and dropping them out of a biplane at 10,000 feet and actually hitting what you're aiming at are two entirely different things, and that led to the Norden bomb site, which is really a computer. Since then, mathematics has branched out throughout Dahlgren, first through ballistics and then later on through bombing tables of World War II, which in turn led to the exterior ballistics group, and that in turn brought in Howard Aiken and the computers. What types of mathematics and computational technology does T Department employ, or what do you have to deal with?
Yeah, we have a special group over in T10, again looking at the GPS and all the system and geolocation, atomic change, effect on gravitational pull, all related towards, you know, the fineness and the anti of GPS, as well as the whole elements, how that fits in, the mensurating various targets and, you know, all the targets here and associated there. So we actually have the oldest mathematician on base in the T10. Still performing and still able to do that. So the mathematics are fundamental, and keeping those honed and being able to apply those are very fundamental. What I've seen is the ability here at Dahlgren to understand the key technologies, to be able to do the signal processing, which is more than just detecting, but actually, you know, understanding it, IDing it, measuring it, tracking it, and then providing that to a solution set so that be able to do something and react and take that into action. So we've always looked at systems in that context. So that's required a lot of disciplines to work across. And whether you're a computer scientist or electrical engineer working some of the computers or just a configuration management and trying to bring about the discipline of the signal processing, all of that's very much woven in all our organizations. That's what brings it about and makes it operate with some confidence. The other part of this that is getting a lot more complex is the ability to take responsibility for some of these products. And I'd say another word for that is to be able to certify these products. In other words, we're willing to take on the role of bringing these out, testing them, checking them, and putting them into the operating regime that they're going to be placed in the real world. And we're willing to put our name on the line that says, we'll certify that that's what we say it is, and that this machine will work in the following conditions and do that reliably and confidently. And we do that also with the mindset that that represents the operating environment that's going to be placed in, that the user will be satisfied with the capabilities of this system. That's something that industry sometimes doesn't have a feel, or in some cases doesn't want the liability associated with that. Somebody has to do that. An 18-year-old hedge can't figure it out, right? Or a senior officer, for that matter, has got other things going on. The last thing they need to do is to worry about whether their equipment is going to work or how it works or if it. So we take that understanding of that system from nuts to bolts over its operating environment very, very seriously. So we're laying out processes to certify products, to certify a combat ship, and a battle group, so that you can deal with that with some certainty as to how it's performing and operating.
Mathematical story is something I think a lot of people, when they think of all these wonderful ship systems and missile systems and the cool weapons technology, they don't realize the mathematical complexities that are involved and what it takes to sit down and, because in the old days, scientists have to sit down and just do calculus, pages and pages and pages of it longhand, and with computers, it's made it so much easier. What types of computers do you guys use? I just talked to Rob Gates up in Strike Systems, and he told me a couple of Crays and essentially PCs. Is that?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, today's computers that you can get at the supermarkets,
2 gigabyte.
Are unbelievable. Yeah. In fact, we have a special branch within T Department specially for just high-level computation, and we did an assessment across the base. Today's computers are such that, you know, with some minor exceptions, you can do all the work that previously required Crays. There are some high-end fluid dynamics, thermodynamics, those type of things, where you need a continuum over large
such large volumes and you need absolute precision because of breaking points or criticalities, and that requires special computers. In that regard, we're able to tap into the DoD that's and buy time off of those. That has been decreasing, the need to do that, because of just the availability of computers that are more than adequate to do those calculations for us. We are doing things like IBMD for missile defense, the trajectory, you know, all the aspects, the detection, all the atmospherics, all the environmental, you know, enormously complex simulations, stimulations of both actual as well as simulated design. So we're doing that more and more, where we understand the complexity, we develop concepts around that, and then we go to the users as to how to lay these out and actually engage them and use them. So we're able to do that more and more.
Are there any stories that you two gentlemen think needs to be in this book, that needs to be told, that we haven't covered? What would you like to see regarding T Department that needs?
Well, I mean, don't leave out the computer bug story. You probably have that one, right?
Mm-hmm.
First computer bug, I'm off the thought.
Anything specific, maybe in the last 10 years? That's really where the dearth of materials is.
I think understanding an entire battle group and being able to baseline that instantly and persistently, so the fleet is able to develop and evolve its concept. It's a change in the role of the laboratory and change in the expertise and the knowledge base that we can provide the fleet that really impacts their ability to be successful and safe. Get them all there and get them all back. And tie in all the threat and all that. To be able to do that in facilities like the DEP downstairs. Mm-hmm. Do that repeatedly and over and over. Right after 9/11, within 3 days, we had 2 Aegis ships at Norfolk that they wanted to put in the Indian Ocean anticipating further problems. They came to us and says, does it make a difference what battle group those 2 ships line themselves up with? Because there were battle groups and they operated in every Indian Ocean. The answer is yes. It does matter. What was validation to me was the fact that the people in OpNav asked us for our advice and our technical input, knowing that these arrangements and when you add or take a ship off, it can affect the overall performance of the battle group. That was validation. The other is when we put 5 battle groups into the Indian Ocean here during the Iraqi, right? Said, we've never done that before. We've done them individually. Now we've got 5 collectively. What are the problems and what are the issues associated with doing that? Well, we were able to lay them out, move them in different positions, align them based upon the threat and the, but also provide them with advisories as to what the limitations of their overall effective capability would be in that operating area. Because some of their gear is 20, 30, many years old, and it is limited. It's not as good as some of the others. It's essential that they know what those limitations are so they not get hurt, they not get killed. And so we did quick assessments on that collective group and then also went back with advisories as to how to use that or not. So I like to think we are intimate and integral to their success, right? And we are doing a better job of getting them the right information to ensure their success over time. I think the work that's going on in fire control systems, naval fire controls, is just revolutionizing. We're going from a weapon, a launcher, a control system, and several bodies in charge and responsible for that. We're going to have an array of weapons we can launch through a variety of means to a fire control that will take care of all of that, and do that in a cohesive, organized fashion to include deconflicting airplanes, friendly and hostile, and the whole nine yards, to include hitting precisely one, to include miles in excess of 1,200 miles from the ship. Very, very phenomenal capability. When we talk about operating littorals, we talk about the new ships that they're thinking about. This is what they've got to have to be able to operate in those areas successfully, and in some cases to ensure that they're only hitting the intended targets and that there is no collateral damage, no supporting things. I believe that trend is going to change the way we operate our Army, and even our Marine Corps. We used to send everything over, put on 4-wheel vehicles, and then move it around and about the country. You don't have to do that today. You can shoot it from the ship that got it there in the first place. That provides us a lot of options, a lot more agile. We can still get to everything. We can still be in total and complete support of them. So I see surface warfare kind of changing significantly. Our national defense to protect against ballistic missile defense, we are that close, in my opinion, of actually being able to solve those kind of problems. There's probably nothing more complex. You think about Star Wars, it's nothing compared to what we're on the verge of doing and capable of doing. And I believe that it's the assets across Falcon, not just in this department, it's the assets across Falcon that are absolutely imperative to that. Right? I don't think they're found all in total, and it's going to require all of that to go into solving those kind of that challenge of, and to be able to bring that about for the sea-based component. Sea-based component not only defends the United States, it's also used as an element of national security to protect other countries from whacking each other. It's tremendously important how we do world affairs and do things on that level. So we've gone from just helping our Navy to, in my opinion, being a very fundamental and foundational organization that's necessary for the most cutting-edge, you know, programs we've got going in the Department of Defense. And not only can we provide the missile defense, we can ensure that it'll work with coalition and the other services in whatever interoperability or method that they want. That, to me, represents a tremendous asset and capability that I think is uniquely Dahlgren.
I can think of another story that goes back a ways that I think represents the Dahlgren way. There's something called the Chemical Warfare Directional Detector, CWDD, which Roger Horman was the lead engineer on at the time we did it, and it was in my branch, Electro-Optical Systems branch, back when that branch was in the in department. The CWDD is a capability for detecting and realizing, you know, the disposition of chemical, various classes of chemical warfare clouds. And it was conceived, engineered, and brought to IOC, initial operation capability, in, I believe, 18 months, might even have been 15 months, a very short period of time. And the conception was here, the engineering was here, you know, the carrying it through the process to get it to IOC was all led out of Dahlgren. Chemical Warfare Directional Detector, I think it's on every ship in the Navy that amounts to anything, of course, including all the carriers.
Well, it's something we haven't found too much of. We found the occasional press release or newspaper clipping about Dahlgren's role in chemical and biological defense. Anything you could add to that?
Well, that included not the history of it. First forward-looking infrared receiver, to my knowledge, that was put in the fleet, at least in the surface fleet. There had been some on carriers before then, but in the surface fleet, that included the first FLIR system as part of a warfare directional detector. And it was also invaluable as a night vision device just to help you navigate, you know, when you're in close quarters, you have heavy weather. But it's a, you know, it's one of the little stories of the kinds of things we can do with Dahlgren and do routinely that often don't get as much recognition as they might.
Thank you for listening to this week's Dahlgren Centennial Podcast, and hopefully you've learned another interesting aspect of what our people accomplish for the Navy and for our nation. We will continue sharing how Dahlgren is a one-of-a-kind location where innovation is heralded as the hallmark of each individual. Tune in next week to hear from Daniel Green, an early computer programmer for the Naval Ordnance Research Calculator, otherwise known as NORC.